Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Throughout Donald Trump's presidency, he's frequently spoke of the threat posed by MS-13, the Mara Salvatrucha, a street gang formed by Salvadorian immigrants here in the United States. Often he speaks of the gang in connection with his administration's policies on immigration. Here's an example from 2017.
Together, we're going to restore safety to our streets and peace to our communities. And we're going to destroy the vile criminal cartel MS-13 and many other gangs. But MS-13 is particularly violent. They don't like shooting people because it's too quick. It's too fast. I was reading one of these animals was caught and explaining they like to knife them and cut them and let them die slowly because that way it's more painful and they enjoy watching that much more. These are animals.
There's no doubt that MS-13 and other street gangs have perpetrated heinous acts and crimes. But today, the Trump administration is prosecuting gang members under anti-terrorism provisions by the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department. My guest today has researched MS-13 for a number of years and says MS-13 is a transnational street gang, not a transnational criminal organization. Stephen Dudley spent 15 years as a journalist in Latin America for the Washington Post, Miami Herald, and the BBC. He's considered one of the top authorities on the street gang and is the co-founder of Insight Crime, a think tank devoted to organized crime in the Americas, and a senior fellow at the American University Center for Latin American Studies. He's actually co-directing a three-year study funded by the U.S. Department of Justice on the street gang. And he's the author of MS-13, The Making of America's Most Notorious Gang. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Dudley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
MS-13 is a gang that is in multiple countries and multiple cities here in the United States and has long been a notorious street gang. But the rhetoric of President Trump has elevated MS-13's notoriety to a new level. Is the president's rhetoric justified?
Look, I think on one level, there is a justification for being fearful of things like the MS-13. I mean, it is an organization that can be extremely violent. It's organized itself across the United States. It's in six different countries in this hemisphere alone. It's in a couple of countries in Europe as well. You know, it is involved in high-level criminal activity in some cases. So on that level, of course, it is justified to be fearful of this organization. But I think what has happened is the debate around it gets conflated with the debate around immigration. We think of the MS-13 and we think of undocumented migrants. That is completely unfair. The numbers or percentages of people from mostly, these are gangs that operate, the MS-13 operates mostly from Latino communities in the United States, for example, these are teeny percentages of people who are going into these gangs. So to conflate, you know, those communities and those populations with the gangs themselves is not fair. What's more, the numbers just simply don't justify it. I mean, in the worst, you know, spates of violence that the MS-13 has had, you know, it doesn't compare to some of the other gangs, you know, other street gangs that are, you know, five times larger, the 18th Street, which is the main rival of the MS-13, you know, never gets mentioned, and it's five times bigger than the MS-13 by the United States government's own estimates, and in many respects, more violent and more sophisticated. So it's become a kind of a trope, you know, and a way to vilify, and I think a very politically useful tool for some people, but a way to vilify entire communities.
Now, you describe MS-13 as a transnational street gang as opposed to a transnational criminal organization. What's the difference in your view?
Well, I think if we're thinking about a transnational street gang, what we're describing is something that has a slightly different goal than a transnational criminal organization. A transnational street gang, in my mind, is an organization that is largely bound by rules and regulations that govern their activities around their connections, around their sort of shared identity and community that they've created.
Is it based on geography too? Their territory?
Certainly based on geography, shared identity, you know, rules and mores that they create over the years. But their main goal as an organization isn't necessarily criminal. Now, certainly they can be involved in criminal activities, but they are extremely violent. And this is often what binds them together, is their sort of collective violence against others and against themselves. But this, as opposed to a transnational criminal organization, which has very specific, mostly economically geared goals, you know, selling drugs or trafficking people across borders or selling contraband or, you know, any number of sort of service-oriented type criminal economies, versus the gang, which is largely bound by this sort of, you know, shared identities and control of territory. And within those territories, for sure, they are committing very often horrendous acts, and their criminal economies are also very often based on control of that territory, most likely extortion. But they have kind of two different end games, and that's really what makes them different.
You're actually right that in the case of MS-13, it's, as a street gang, it's the social network first, criminality second, as opposed to a criminal organization, which is all about, you know, making money through criminal activity.
This is the key element to think about. What is it that makes them who they are? You know, we think, or at least we're told, that they're this kind of huge drug cartel, for instance. In the research that I've done over the last, you know, in the 40-year existence of the MS-13, for example, there are some individuals who have tried to use this kind of natural network that they have that does spread across these half dozen nations just in this hemisphere and would seemingly be a sort of perfect distribution network. And they have tried to use that seemingly perfect distribution network to sell drugs, to move drugs from one place to another and then to sell them in what is the most lucrative drug markets in all of the world, places like Los Angeles and Houston and New York. And they have always failed. And they've always failed, in part, in my mind, because that's not what the organization is built for. The organization, in fact, what it does to people who do become kind of large criminal actors in and of themselves, they get isolated, they get pushed out, and then eventually they get captured. So in each one of these cases in which they, and I chronicle about a half dozen, they try and become this international drug trafficking organization, they fail. They fail because that's not what they're about. They're about this sort of social cohesion that's built around territory, built around collective violence. You know, not good things, but it's not a sort of mafia or drug trafficking organization like we might think of it.
Let's take a step back. You actually, in the book, tell us a story of how Mara Salvatrucha 13, first of all, what does that mean, and how did it get started?
Well, the Mara Salvatrucha name is a combination of names. Mara in Salvadoran lingo means kind of originally meant a small, rambunctious group of friends. And that evolved over time. All the groups that were small, rambunctious groups of friends, or a lot of them, became gangs. So it became a euphemism for gangs in El Salvador. So that's the Mara part. And then the Salvatrucha, we kind of have to break that up into pieces. The Salva is sort of a reference to El Salvador, so this sort of shared national identity. And then Trucha has different meanings, you know, thought of as sort of savvy, or another way of thinking, people use it as sort of a, you know, watch out, look out, Trucha, you know, keep an eye out. So that sort of thing. So be careful or keep an eye out. So it has a combination of meanings there. So you have the Mara, Salva, Trucha. You put that all together and you get the gang's name itself. The gang comes from really shared experiences of mostly refugee families that were displaced during the Civil War period of the 1980s in El Salvador. So they come up in droves to places like Los Angeles in particular and settle in some of the most densely populated, socially disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged areas of Los Angeles, Central LA in particular, so Koreatown, Rampart Village, Wilshire. And they find themselves in what is sort of growing, almost really sort of multi-immigration group gang war, because there are hundreds of gangs in L.A. at that stage, and you're going into a place that is increasingly well-armed. They're using new tactics to fight each other, like drive-by shootings. There are increasing amounts of drugs being sold in their areas where they live. In particular, use of crack is about to explode. So this is the environment in which these refugees are landing in this space. And there's a lot of competition amongst these immigrant groups for scarce resources, and people get left out. So people are fighting with each other. People are being left out. People are fighting for scant resources. And it's in this environment that gangs really, you know, surge and begin to fight one another. And one of them is this Mara Salvatrucha, you know, which coalesces around their shared identities and experiences and everything that, that is happening around them. So, you know, this is the early 1980s of L.A. This evolution then, you know, kind of spreads out within L.A. And beyond, and then eventually across the U.S., and they begin to be jailed in greater and greater numbers. And eventually they begin this process of sort of going back to their, not voluntarily, they begin being deported in mass numbers back to places in Central America, in particular El Salvador. So we're starting to see the beginnings of what has become this sort of vicious circle.
This was the interesting thing to me. I always assumed MS-13 started in Central America, you know, Salvador, El Salvador, or Honduras, Guatemala, these countries where MS-13 does have a significant presence. And it actually started in L.A. and was basically deported back to these countries.
This is often very startling for people from the United States. As you said, most or many people think that they were born in El Salvador. That's because over the years, they have become a much larger presence in El Salvador, while in the United States, there may be anywhere from, you know, 8 to 10,000 members at the sort of best U.S. estimate there. In a place like El Salvador, which is obviously a much smaller country with just, you know, 7 or 8 million people, they have closer to 30,000 members. So, you know, you can see why people might believe that they were born in El Salvador, in addition to the fact that they have this, you know, the kind of shared identity of Salvadorans, and it really has become the kind of epicenter of MS-13 activities over the years. The reality of the region, you know, when they did get deported back to it, was that it was very fertile terrain for the MS-13 and also the 18th Street, which is also was also born in Los Angeles, but has been deported or exported, depending upon who you talk to, to places like Central America, and they found very fertile terrain. This is post-war areas, you know, mostly we're talking about Guatemala and El Salvador in that regard, but also Honduras, where they were able to overrun the local Maras, the original Maras, these sort of rambunctious small groups of kids that had operated in El Salvador. And then these local Maras just sort of assumed the bigger brand names, the U.S. brand names. So in a way, they were kind of part of this perverse side of globalization.
Before we talk about some of the stories you write about in the book, one of the things you mentioned was we think of MS-13 in the political rhetoric today as this immigration issue. It's really a refugee story. And in all of the stories that you tell through a pseudonym named Norman, Alex Sanchez, and Alma, the idea that the wars in Central America, which just scattered these three individuals that you write about, their family, I mean, in certain cases, their families were spread over 1,000 miles. That's a big part of what became MS-13 sort of attractiveness in whatever reason. It was a safety vehicle for at least a couple of these young people.
I think that that's a really important point. We think about the gang as predatory, and they are without question predatory. But for a lot of these kids whose families are torn to pieces, whether it's by war, whether it's economic circumstances, whether it's personal circumstances, one of the characters, for example, is raped by her step-grandfather and then joins the gang. That's Alma. And, you know, they're torn apart by all these different things. And what they find in the gang is not just a sort of shared identity or surrogate family is what many of them, although they may not use those terms, that's really what they're talking about, is kind of a surrogate family. But what they also find is protection. And it could be protection from that very gang. So, you know, one way to protect yourself from the bullies is to join the bullies. And I think we definitely have bits and pieces of that. I think the other thing about these stories is they do have a lot of commonalities. There's an incredible amount of abuse in these homes, you know, physical and sexual. And so that's a very common thing with, you know, not just gang members, but criminals in general. You know, so there's that shared experience. There's a shared experience of losing parents or having parents move very far away for long periods of time. So you're kind of, you know, you're a disjointed family at best. There's certainly shared experiences as it relates to, you know, lacking social services and poor educational opportunities. And so you have all these shared experiences, and that's really why I picked a lot of these stories, is because I felt like they were representative of the whole. And in most of the stories that, and it's kind of hard to say exactly how representative this is of the gang, because we don't have the exact statistics of how many were born in the United States versus, you know, were born in El Salvador. But, you know, a good portion of the ones that I have met over the years either were, you know, most of them were born in El Salvador when they were very young, maybe came up when they were very young to the United States. And a few of them were, you know, came from the United States. But they shared that experience of kind of having a split personality, you know, not really being able to feel like you're settled in any one place, whether it's in El Salvador or in the United States. And to a certain extent, it's this really torturous relationship that exists between the United States and places like El Salvador, which is really more of a kind of neo-colony than it is a separate country. It's completely dependent on the United States for so many things. You know, on the one hand, to sort of sell most of its commodities. And then on the other hand, you know, about a fifth of all Salvadoran people born in the United States or born in El Salvador live in the United States currently. So, you know, this is close to 2 million people who are sending back, you know, what is representative of about 20% of that country's economy comes from remittances or sent back.
Yeah, and in fact, I was going to say, in fact, the U.S. currency, the currency in El Salvador is the U.S. dollar.
It is, in fact, the U.S. dollar. So, in a way, this is what we're looking at is kind of the ugly side of globalization. You know, what I call it, I call them the bastard child of this sort of unrecognized relationship. That is the MS-13. They're the result of this unequal, you know, really exploitative relationship that has been built between these two countries.
Norman is a person that shows up throughout the entire book, and Alex Sanchez is another one where, you know, his parents, at least a parent, was in the United States. He was in El Salvador. He's basically picked up by some version of a coyote who takes him into the United States. You know, they get to the border with his brother and they just turn around and say, "You're our children. Keep quiet." And that's how he gets to the United States. And when he gets to the United States, he is utterly alone in a world of gangs. MS-13 was his protection from other gangs.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the main thrusts of the book, is to think of these choices that are made with at least more context around them. You know, the story that we get of gangs is by the time they're in orange jumpsuits with handcuffs behind their back or not, or sitting in a courtroom and we're hearing about a machete murder. And those are horrible, and we need to obviously prosecute everybody who's involved in that. But what we don't often get is everything leading up to that. And this is a bit of an effort to at least, you know, at least provide that context, that understanding. I am by no means saying that we need to exonerate anybody for any criminal acts, under no circumstances. I do think we need police. I do think we need very smart ways of going after this. But I also think we need to think about ways in which we can mitigate gangs like the MS-13 long before they become what they've become. And that's part of the story of going through people like Alex's story, so we can illustrate that he did fall into this environment in which he felt like he couldn't speak like he would have normally spoke, you know, using certain styles of, you know, speech that he would have with his other Salvadoran mates, because then he would have been, you know, vilified or bullied by the other Mexican-American students. And then when he did find that group that had that shared identity and did speak like he used to speak, because he'd been scared off from speaking that way, he embraced them. He embraced them immediately. And at that point, they were a really rudimentary group. And, you know, they had long hair and they were really more about heavy metal music than they were about, you know, they were a sort of very rough facsimile of what we know today. You know, they were banging their heads quite literally to AC/DC and Iron Maiden and things of that sort. That's what they coalesced around. And that was the gang that he joined in the middle of all these, of all this tumult in LA that just steadily got worse. And with it, the MS-13 became more sophisticated and began to confront other gangs in due course with more sophisticated weaponry, in addition to sort of traditional weaponry like machetes. So this is the evolution of these individuals, the evolution of this gang. And then I think the third part of the book is the evolution of our response to that gang.
Yeah, and our response to that gang. What have we done well, but what have we done poorly in response?
I think that, you know, the initial response to beef up policing units that specialize in this and that work from, you know, intelligence-based information took a long while to get to, but eventually we moved in that direction. So there begins a sort of effort to really become smarter about how we're dealing with gangs, creation of databases, laws that specifically, you know, are geared to deal with the worst of gangs, which is really about violence more than anything else. Certainly the other criminal activities, but first and foremost, violence, you know, and that's something I think that we can understand. And especially if we think back on the 1980s, that was just this period of tumult of all kinds of violence, you know, not just between gangs, but drug trafficking organizations and the tremendous spike in the use of crack cocaine. So we can understand that. But what happened was it kind of got out of control, and it begins to take over every part of our response. So all the resources are going towards these units, are going towards creation of these laws and implementation of these laws. And we're forgetting about the other components, which are the really important parts of integrating immigrant communities in our neighborhoods, in our lives. So we're talking about social services and job programs and ESL education programs. You know, all of these things get pushed aside. The amount of money that goes to them dwindles, and greater emphasis is on jailing our way out of the problem. And so that becomes the solution. And that is a short-sighted solution for many reasons, not the least of which is because when the gang becomes part of this sort of prison environment, it becomes integrated in more sophisticated prison-based criminal groups. Most notably, the Mexican Mafia puts them under their larger gang umbrella, which is this massive gang umbrella of up to 50 gangs that operates under the prison gang known as the Mexican Mafia. So all of a sudden now, they're in jail in greater numbers. There's the same numbers outside of jail. And now they're working with a more sophisticated criminal organization. Mm. And you compound that by deporting them in mass numbers. And now you've exported the problem. So you can see how one thing kind of steadily leads to another.
One of the interesting stories that you tell in this book is this story of Norman, who joined the gang. He was probably a very active and enthusiastic participant. And he spent time in prison, multiple prisons. But at some point he says, I want to leave this life. And his story is one of how does he leave this life? How does he negotiate his way in his home country, El Salvador, where, you know, he's a dead man walking on the street because of his former affiliation. And he can't come to the United States because of these affiliations.
I mean, Norman is the center of the book for a lot of reasons. He carries the book from A to Z.
Yes.
he is the representation of this paradox that we have. He's the victim. You know, he grew up in a very abusive family. His family's torn apart by war. Half of his family moves up to the United States. A bunch of his brothers join the gang in L.A. You know, his sort of brother that was really his surrogate father is murdered in Houston, Texas. But then he's also a victimizer. All of this sort of leads him into the hands of the gang. He is, you know, very active participant in gang activities. And although to me he denied a good number of these criminal acts, I went back and recuperated the judicial documents to illustrate his deep involvement in these criminal activities. And they include the worst that you can think of, you know, including murder. And so he ends up in jail in El Salvador for these murders and really gets a front row seat to the next evolution of the gang. Inside of the prison system of El Salvador, he becomes part of the leadership council, what's called La Ranfla, and they begin to organize themselves. They become much more sophisticated, both in controlling their space inside of prison, but also using that control, just like the Mexican mafia does in California, using the control of prisons in order to control their rank and file outside of prisons. And they become increasingly sophisticated. So this is a person who has lived on both sides of the equation, you know, is sort of a great representation of this paradox that we have when we face these gang members. And eventually, as most gang members do, and I would emphasize this, most gang members grow out of it. They have families. They get jobs. They just don't want to do it anymore. It's just not something you want to do for life in most circumstances. Very few of these guys are in this for life, but it can be very difficult to leave the gang. And that's what Norman finds out. You know, you can't just, especially El Salvador, you can't just pick up and leave. You've got to figure out different strategies to leave. You know, and one strategy is you tell them that I'm going to just calm down, they say. I'm going to calm down. They call it calmao. I'm going to calm down. And, you know, if that's open to you, yes, you can do that. And they'll kind of just sort of leave you alone. Another strategy might be if you join the evangelical church and say, I'm going to be completely committed to this church. They may leave you go that way. And another strategy is the Norman strategy, which is just escape, just get out of their grasp. But as the book illustrates, that is also very difficult. And you will be looking over your shoulder for probably the rest of your life.
Norman goes through the asylum system. He's granted provisional asylum, but his future is very much uncertain and in doubt.
Absolutely. It's a very difficult thing to have, you know, one, your at least a temporary relief is what they call it from being sent back to El Salvador, where he is, you know, faces a really strong likelihood, more than 50% likelihood of facing torture and or death by the government, you know, not by anyone, by the El Salvadoran government. And so the judge makes that decision, and then the result is not necessarily freedom. That's, you know, the result is he's out, but he now has to face this really other risky situation, which is that he has defied the gang.
Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich.
Stephen Dudley is a senior fellow at the Center for Latin American Studies at American University and the co-founder of the think tank Insight Crime, and the author of MS-13, The Making of America's Most Notorious Gang. It's published by Hanover Square Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.